best practice and what's more beneficial to them.
I agree. And by the way, I just started recording. I can edit out stuff and all of that, but sometimes it's good. Just, I always feel like the best stuff is when I'm riffing with my homies. Like,
so, you know, I'll cut down on the swearing.
Yeah, no, please do. No, but look, I want to first and foremost, you know, as we just get into this, thank you. We're finally doing this podcast episode with my good friend, Ian Adair, the executive director of the Grace Point Foundation in Tampa. So that's about as formal as we'll get because you know, we've been together multiple times. I know you were recently in Austin not too long ago, and we hung out a bunch at the Charity Charge office, and then also, you know, we're able just to get out and have some fun. With the boy, now I'm thinking about the band. It wasn't Big Head Todd. I compared him to that. Who did we see?
Oh my, that was I knew if you asked. The band that I forced you, yes. The group, that was Jacko Pierce.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Legendary band from Dallas. Love them to death, been around. They started when they were at SMU together, I think in 88. I think it was 88. And now they're getting back together, touring. They've been doing a lot of stuff on Instagram and Stage It and some other innovative platforms during this time of self-isolation and quarantine. But yeah, anybody that I know that I could subject to their music, I seem to somehow work that in. So I was glad we had a good group of people able to go.
I loved it. No, we had a lot of fun going there. And you know, look, I think that I'm really glad that we're finally doing this. I know it's crazy times right now with COVID-19 and everything happening, but you, just kind of switching gears here, you, for the purpose of the podcast and for our audience and anyone listening along, you've really been someone that's taught me a lot. I think I'm hoping that we're learning together as well about all things related to nonprofits and marketing and fundraising and whatnot, but I've really looked up to you and it's been really a pleasure to be able to interact with you and have you as part of the Charity Charge community. The irony of the whole thing is, you know, I had this idea, but I had never run a nonprofit myself. So I've picked up a lot from you and other people that, you know, are just awesome people in the nonprofit community. So I'm excited to learn more and interview you today. So thanks for being here.
I appreciate that. You know, I tell you all the time, whenever and wherever you'd like to throw praise upon me, I will take it, my friend.
That's my job. That's first and foremost. I need to make all guests feel great about themselves.
That's part of what we all work on in the nonprofit industry. We work for a little bit of money and a whole lot of praise and gratitude.
Yeah. No, so,
but no, it's been a great friendship. It's been a great relationship. You have an amazing product. You're helping people do good work. And I think we need our sector and our industry that encompasses so many things, whether it's software, development tools, or fundraising related, or infrastructure and admin related, like Charity Charge is. People need help doing the things that they want to do to better the world. And you're doing that, my friend, and I appreciate what you're doing. And I'm excited as your organization continues to grow and serve more nonprofits in our community and around the world.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I want to touch on a few things, mostly related to your newest article that was in Advancing Philanthropy magazine. We'll talk about that. But before we do, can you share with the audience a bit of your background and a few of the different organizations that you've run?
Sure. I've been very fortunate to have the opportunity. Right now, the Grace Point Foundation is my third foundation or third organization, nonprofit organization that I've been able to lead. My first endeavor was several years ago, about 15 years ago, for a Boys and Girls Club organization in Kansas, in Wichita, Kansas, which was a lot of fun. I'd been part of the Boys and Girls Club movement, as we call it, for about 10, 11 years. And that was kind of a great experience for me. A first experience at a leadership role, which was learned a lot of lessons. And it helped really launch my career. The second opportunity I had was running the Edgar Martinez Foundation in Seattle, Washington, which was a really unique experience and a lot of fun for me to work for a Hall of Fame baseball player, but to work for somebody too that cared so greatly about equity in education, teacher diversity, and really did a lot for the communities and the school districts of the state of Washington. And we were able to, when Edgar went back to work for the Seattle Mariners baseball organization, to continue the work that we were doing, because we were running on a very small infrastructure, just a few staff, merge it and spend some time really thoughtfully merging it with a much larger organization, with the funds and the infrastructure, to really take it on and take it to that next level. So we were very excited to do that after 6 years of running the organization. And we did a lot of great work, and I'm super proud and excited about all the things that we accomplished. And I'm super excited for the new organization that continues to do that great work, to continue that legacy. And so I think all those two experiences really were able kind of to give me the foundation of nonprofit management, nonprofit leadership. Again, each time you get the opportunity, you learn a lot of things that you wish you would have known from the previous one. So that being said, led me 3 years ago. Actually, today is my 3-year anniversary, April 10th for the Grace Point Foundation. So yeah, it's a nice quarantine cupcake kind of day. But you know, it's been an amazing 3 years, because I never thought I would come back to lead an organization unless I truly had a personal connection to the mission. And just for the listeners out there, Grace Point, the organization of which the foundation is the philanthropic arm, is the largest behavioral health organization in West Florida. We serve roughly about 30,000 plus individuals through a number of means, whether it's mental health, substance abuse services, homeless services, a lot of case management. So we're doing some amazing work in our community with a number of different populations. I have, and I'm very open and talk about the issues and challenges and battles that my family and myself have had with mental health. And so I had a strong personal connection to what we do, and was excited to take on this role, knowing I've had those other two opportunities to learn from past mistakes and also successes with fundraising and board development and program management. So I was excited to do that. And for the last 3 years, we've continued to grow. It's been really exciting and really become a leader in the awareness space in our community, not only about mental health, but a lot of also what I would consider challenges to learning about mental health would be addressing stigma of mental health and substance abuse. And then also moving one step forward to letting people know that it's not just an individual issue, it's a community issue, it's a corporate issue, and we should be servicing and supporting our employees in our businesses as well. And so having a lot of fun bringing that awareness to the corporate side.
100%. And, you know, I want to get into this, but I'll just read, you know, this headline, and I'm going to interview you a bit and ask some questions about it. But, you know, I know you just published this piece in Advancing Philanthropy magazine titled Mental Health Awareness: How Nonprofits Can Champion Mental Health, Support Employees, and Create a Work Culture That Is Stronger Than Stigma. In it, you know, you outlined four specific strategies that nonprofits can incorporate. And so, you know, I'd love for you to kind of go over those four and share with us, you know, what you're putting out there. I think that on this topic, before we do it, what I've really appreciated about you, and this was probably came up in one of our earlier conversations, but you really are championing a lot of the conversation around mental health within, you know, the organization itself. And I think something that I just share with you and for anyone listening, whether they're, you know, an employee at a nonprofit or, you know, in a executive director type of role, or it's just someone who is the donor of, I think that we lose sight, and I had, you know, didn't have this perspective of just the challenges and how stressful it can be running an organization or being an employee of. And even on the micro side, you know, the role that, for example, a development director would play, and sometimes the uneasiness that someone in a development director role could have if they're I'm thinking the right word, you know, potentially like sexually harassed by a donor. How do they communicate that to their leadership? So I don't want to derail the whole thing, but I just think that you've helped bring up to me this concept that we have, you know, employees of nonprofits that are tirelessly dedicating their lives to advancing some sort of mission. And that, you know, we really need to look out for them. And so I think it's really amazing what you're doing and the conversation that you're creating. So feel free to comment on any of that, but also I would love it, you know, to make this action oriented for you to talk about those four strategies that you went over.
Right. Well, I think before we get into the strategies, I think you were laying the context for really the foundation of the article. And I applaud AFP, the Association of Fundraising Professionals, for the work they are doing. Nonprofits do so much good work, but it doesn't mean we don't still have things that we need to address in our sector. And you mentioned some of those things, whether it's equity at the leadership level, whether it's gender pay equity, whether it's sexual harassment, whether it's a toxic work culture, kind of all of these things, the Chronicle of Philanthropy, Association of Fundraising Professionals, and other groups and leaders throughout North America have really taken this on. And I applaud their efforts because these are tough conversations to have, but they need to be had. And I think we can only improve our sector when we have them. And I think when you look at, you know, surveys that have gone out that really kind of address, you know, some of these things, we have to see that, okay, if fundraisers are saying that they like their job, but then the next question we ask them is, do you plan to leave in the next 2 years? And just more than half of them say yes. Those two things don't correspond. And then we take it one step further and we find out that like 30% of them are planning to leave the sector altogether. Then it really doesn't make sense. So you don't have those kind of statistics about people wanting to leave their job or people wanting to leave the profession altogether, unless there was some deep inherent things that need to be addressed and dealt with. And those are some of the things that we've been doing in the sector the last couple of years. All I'm trying to do with the mental health awareness piece is realize that all of these things that we're talking about impact your mental health. So if you're not being paid a fair wage, you're struggling to make bills at home, that impacts your mental health. If you're not getting the respect from your leadership, if you're having unfair expectations in your workload, in your metrics and in your targets, especially with fundraising, that's impacting your mental health. It's just a lot of those things. I just wanted to bring it all together. I got a little bit frustrated, in all honesty, Stephen, reading month after month after month as people try to address the retention issue with development directors. And it always kind of seemed like it was the same three or four things. And I'm like, it's got to be deeper than that, because if we've been putting that narrative out for years, I'd say 5, 6, 7 years of why development directors stay an average of 18 months, then we should have solved that problem by now. So I think I knew it was deeper. I thought it could be deeper. I think the recent surveys in the last 2 years around leadership equity, gender pay equity, and sexual harassment have really kind of proven that. And I think this mental health piece was the final piece that kind of encompasses all together.
I'm really glad, you know, you're talking about all that. You know, something that comes up that I want to say to you that I've experienced a lot, you know, you're talking about inside the organization, so to speak. I want to share with you that, you know, as you know, we've now funded over 950 nonprofits nationwide. And, you know, I've been blessed to have a lot of really close relationships with the executive directors or CFOs at a lot of those organizations. I'll tell you that one of the top things that comes up is them being stressed out about their board and that type of interaction. And I know that there's a lot, I mean, I could just, it's call after call, right? So it's just a repeated pattern. I'm curious, you know, you've had, you're now running your executive director of your third organization. You've obviously had different stakeholders and different boards at all those different nonprofits. And I like that. And I think you have an interesting perspective because they're structured differently. One was part, you know, Boys and Girls Club, part of a national network. The other one was, you know, founded by an influential person. And then now you're part of essentially a healthcare system. So what kind of advice would you give to someone that is stressed out about their board, maybe because the board members aren't putting in enough maybe sweat equity or just equity, or they feel pressured by the board to meet deadlines. Like, you know, kind of just curious your perspective on it. It's not necessarily one question here, but just this idea of there are a lot of leaders out there that are stressed out about their boards. How can they be more proactive about that? How does a nonprofit executive director put together a great board and kind of manage that board?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that question. But it's a great question because it kind of leads to even some of the things that we're going to talk about concerning mental health of employees and an organization. I think one of the reasons usually always mentioned when you talk about retention, whether it's executive leadership or development directors and professionals, always concerns unrealistic expectations from their board. And I think that can then break off into a couple of other conversations. Boards understanding their fundraising role in the organization. And I think also the other one would be, like you said, kind of the sweat equity. What are they willing to do? How are they willing to, you know, kind of quote unquote, open their Rolodex and raise awareness and continually keep the organization top of mind to be what we would call a productive board member? And it really comes down to a couple of things. And like I said, having the opportunity to lead three organizations, I've learned a lot of lessons, but I think it starts with board recruitment and expectation. I think that's sometimes where a lot of groups really kind of have a big miss in wanting to recruit somebody that they value, whether it's somebody influential in the community, whether it's somebody with a lot of capacity, whether it's somebody who has industry ties. We want to only give them the rosy picture. We only want to give them the highlights. We only want to tell them the successes. And I think we back off a little bit from saying, oh, and after all of that, we want you to also understand there's a meeting commitment. There's an engagement commitment to come to events. There's a fundraising commitment, and there's a fundraising minimum. And you start going through all that because you feel like if you're too transparent, you'll lose out on that person, where actually we're discovering the more transparent you are and the more upfront you are, you're going to find the right person is going to want to connect with you. So it starts with that expectation and that onboarding, but you also got to continually educate your board on how to be the best board member. And there is no class in your MBA program. There is no class. And if you're running a corporation, it says, let me take you aside and tell you how to be a community leader on a board. You figure this out as you go. It really is the definition of on-the-job training. Now, yeah, there's things available, but you usually don't find out about those things unless you're someone in your organization forwards it to you. So we have to really take charge of educating our board on what's going on in the sector. We have to take charge of educating a board on best practices. And we have to take the time to do it as well. You just can't say, I got a lot to update them in an hour. And by the time they're done having their, you know, their free sandwich and chips and a drink, that we don't have time for education. You got to make it a priority. And so it really comes down to that. It's that onboarding, understanding those expectations, holding them to those expectations, and continually educating them on how to be the best they can be. Because I don't really know too many board members that want to be brought onto a board to not be productive, to be inefficient, and to not add value to the organization. That really isn't the case. I know we can think that's the case, or we can jump to that conclusion if we're frustrated or upset, but that really isn't the case. I know a lot of folks that I talked to when I took over what I would consider at each of the times I took over an organization that was having a lot of troubles, whether it was with fundraising or retention or whatever it was. There was great board leadership at all those organizations, but they weren't educated the right way. And there was a lot that I would ask them. They're like, we've never been told that. We didn't know. So when you have a lack of anything, you'll go in any direction. And so it's really up to those organizational leaders to step in and say, you know, we all want to be successful here. We're all doing this for the betterment of a population we serve. Here are some best practices. Let's talk about this.
Are there things when you say that, like any organizations out there, either in West Florida or just nationally, or does AFP even do any sort of board training? that you know that you might plug, or just if someone's listening and then they're, you know, they're an ED and they're wondering where to get resources or whatnot for their board?
There's a lot of great sources out there. I'd probably say one of the best sources out there is Board Source. It is probably one of the top organizations to go to their website. They have templates and links to just about anything. Anytime you're on social media, you'll see when you're following anybody in the nonprofit industry, whether it's a consultant or an organization like Foundation Center or Board Source or Bloomerang or any of these groups that have really great access to webinars, produce great content.
Right now,
this board. So yeah, it really is essential, because you know, thinking about, you know, the foundation for any organization starts with the bylaws, you know, starts with organizational and board expectations, and getting people on board and to sign off on those, that they agree that that's the best way to go. You really can't get much better than that. But there are a lot of things out there. I think the group, which has kind of been funny to me over the last, you know, 25 years I've been doing this, the group that has really stepped up the most is probably the nonprofit social sector software industry. And they are producing content now, whether that's Classy, whether that's QGive, whether that's Bloomerang, whether that's Blackbaud. They are probably producing the most content that could add a lot of value to executive directors and board leadership.
I'm happy to hear that. I just signed up for the Board Source newsletter myself, because I really want to figure out ways to collaborate with them. I mean, I'll just tell you, I'm just talking out loud here. Everything that we're talking about right now is on, just specific to your areas. You know, we started this about like mental health within organizations. And then, you know, I'd ask a question of kind of extending it out to the board. But it's unbelievable to me, the lack of awareness that many, many boards have. And these are people, as you point out, you know, they're a board member for oftentimes, certainly the right reasons. They're passionate about the cause. They want to help out. They want to make a difference. But even on our side, not mental health, on the, you know, kind of concept of financial stability, we see so much misinformation. You know, it's not uncommon that we'll have an executive director reach out to us because they're using debit cards, for example, and she wants to open an account with Charity Charge for the organization. And she'll bring it back to the board if that's part of their bylaws or their process. And the board members will say, "Oh, well, debit cards are so much safer. No, we're not gonna allow you to open up, you know, a line of credit for the nonprofit." And I'll step in and I'll educate the board, and they'll quickly understand it. We put out some content on that of like risks and downsides of debit cards. But it's been shocking to me that anyone can be a board member in a sense. You know, but there are, and if you don't mind going into that, actually, because I'm really curious, sincerely, to learn myself from a legal and fiduciary responsibility perspective, what are really the, from an almost like an IRS perspective, what are the responsibilities of the board? Because I think a lot of people join boards and don't really understand how serious it is.
Right. I mean, plain and simple, governance and fiduciary. That's your top two, I would say, basic, bottom of the triangle, foundational things you have to understand going into it. Because if the organization is ever in any type of legal situation, you're going to be named as one of the entities over that organization. So you have you're legally bound to the organization when you're on a board. And I think some people realize that. I think some don't, but I think most realize that as their minimum obligation of governance and fiduciary. I think where the issue is with most nonprofits, and probably a lot of the ones you work with, or what are those other top two or three layers of that triangle that boards need to do? And I think a lot of people still believe, there still is an old school mindset that if I'm doing just what I'm legally bound to do, I'm done. Or that my name is being lent to your organization, so I'm done. So there is a little bit of misunderstanding about that. I think some people forget that, and they need to realize that when they're onboarded.
I'm taking notes, brother. I'm like, I just want you to know, if you heard the keyboard clicking or whatever, like, this is, thank you. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of people sometimes go, oh, you're asking me to be on a board. Yes, right away, yes. And they don't hear anything else. And you have to understand that you're legally bound to that organization. I think most of the problems nowadays with boards are just, what are those other layers that I have to do? What's the engagement piece? What's the fundraising piece? What's the leadership piece? What's the awareness piece? What are all these other things that I need to do? I really do think most understand the responsibility, but they kind of, it kind of brushes off them, because they're like, surely our organization will never get in trouble legally. But then we see every week, every month, some nonprofit that, has done something either unethical or their leadership gets in trouble for doing something. And everyone always says the same thing. Where was the board? Where was the oversight? Where was the supervision? So you always have to be cognizant of those things. I just think right now, especially in the time that we're in, with a lot of groups that are going to be struggling with fundraising, a lot of groups that are going to be struggling putting together their fiscal year through their current means, meaning events and major gifts and grants and all these things that are going to be impacted by COVID-19 and what's going on in the United States. We have to look at those other things and say, how can we pivot? How can we transition our organization so they can get through these tough times? So, I think there's outliers on the governance piece, but I think most know that. I think, and BoardSource, again, is a great resource for a lot of that type of stuff. But I think for a majority of nonprofits, this is going to be a challenging time to transition to new models of revenue that they're going to be uncomfortable with, and they are going to need their board leadership to make that happen.
100%. I'm going to put together a sister kind of, we were already going to do it now. We're doing kind of some sister blogs to the podcast anyway, but I just took some notes down, and I would love to get your feedback, because I really want to put out some more content around this topic. You know, it's super insightful to me. So first and foremost, I just want to make sure I thank you, because this is, I'm always learning, and I hope by extension, these conversations help others.
Well, I think it'd add a lot of benefit to all the people you work with, all the groups you work with. I think, again, going back to me applauding the software industry, for the longest time, they were just concerned about putting together a great product. And that's all they really had to do. And I think today, if you're going to win attention, you really have to get, or to win attention and provide the most value, you have to do that with your customers. So I think everything today is about who can provide the most value, and that's going to get the most eyeballs on you. And I applaud those groups for continuing to reach out to nonprofit professionals and industry influencers and consultants and organizational leaders to be available to offer expertise to folks. And I think, organizations to say they can help me with A, B, and C with my organization in terms of fundraising, board development, and their product, but there's another way they can help, and that's with this board education, awareness, and training piece.
Super important. No, I'm really glad you highlighted that. As we kind of are just starting to round out this episode, first of all, it's been a long time coming, so I hope to have you as a repeat and frequent guest as we just continue to grow our friendship. So certainly more episodes to come. I know we kept it a bit, high level, but also went into some nuances here. Any other things on your mind that you'd like to share?
Well, I think let's circle back to the article a little bit, because we kind of prepped the audience
over the four
strategies, and they didn't get it.
Strategies
left them in the cold. So
I was just trying to keep the audience, baited. So yeah, let's get it.
No, I'm happy to do that. I was coming up with these strategies. I think we have to understand one thing. There's a lot of people that understand mental illness to some level. They understand substance abuse to some level. We continually hear the same statistic over and over and over again, and I think we've become desensitized to it. And I think the statistic itself even waters down the issue, that being 1 in 5 will deal with some kind of mental health issue in their lifetime. And anytime I'm in a room, whether it's 50 people or 1,500 people, I always ask the question, who in this room has been impacted or influenced or somehow affected by a mental health illness, suicide, substance abuse, either with yourself, your family, or your inner circle? And 97, 98% of the people in the room stand up or raise their hand. So to say one in five really doesn't do this issue the justice that it needs, because we're all impacted by it. And then you hear statistics that are alarming, that suicide is the number two cause of death for 10-year-olds to 34-year-olds. You hear that suicide is the number four cause of death from 34-year-olds to 54-year-olds. And it's the number eight cause of death for 55-year-olds on up. And that's alarming because we're not talking about it. We hear statistics that someone in our service person is dying by suicide, I've heard 18 to 22 seconds. That's incredibly alarming. We've lost more veterans to suicide than we had in Vietnam. So these are things that I think are finally getting the attention they deserve. It's unfortunate that mental health and substance abuse are becoming trending topics on social media because of negative things like high profile suicides, like celebrities disclosing, like mass shootings, even though it's been researched and documented that only 4% of violent crime is committed by somebody with a diagnosed mental illness. But it's brought it to the forefront. But now that it's there, what are we doing about it? And so the article was kind of written to understand that, knowing that organizations, like especially nonprofits, with very tight budgets, that run on very thin margins, that would look at something like this going, I don't have the budget to put in a wellness program. I don't have a budget to also worry about my employees' mental health. I was just able to get them benefits to worry about their physical health. So, I think that was kind of the onus of the article, and then to understand the power of stigma, because stigma is what prevents us from getting help. And the research again shows that if we're having negative thoughts or suicide ideation, or if we're feeling depressed, it takes on average 8 to 10 years to get help. And that's tough because, you know, if you turn off this podcast and turn around and sprain your ankle to a point where you can't walk, are you going to wait 8 to 10 years to get it fixed? So those are just kind of the things that have led us to say, let's address mental health in the best way possible. And that's what led to the article, because I know the power of stigma. Stigma keeps people like you and me and people that are listening today from getting help. I can understand Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson talking about he was depressed at one point in his life when things weren't good. I can understand Ryan Reynolds talking about anxiety. I can understand NBA athletes talking about pressures and anxiety, and Michael Phelps. But these are people who are so publicly scrutinized in the media that an average person like you or me would be like, well, if I was that scrutinized and followed around by paparazzi, I probably too would have anxiety and things like that. So what about the rest of us? And who's speaking to the rest of us? Because I think the rest of us, when we start having negative thoughts, we're scared. And we have real fear to lose the three things that are most important in our life, and that's our family, our friends, and our jobs. So who are we going to disclose to? And there is real fear. There is real fear there. So what I was, you know, kind of putting out in the article is we have to address stigma. We have to do it in a way that makes employees who are either suffering and managing recovery or managing a mental illness, or those that have dealt with suicide in their family and are feeling that extreme, profound grief and loss. How can we better help them? And we can do it in a way that's low cost or no cost.
I resonate with all those things that you've said, you know, and I really battle it myself, you know, in my own way. And I think one of the things that I've really had to appreciate, I like how you gave the example of the Rock or Michael Phelps or other of these, you know, high profile people. I think that one of the things that I've had to really learn over the past year for myself personally is that it's no better or worse. It just is what it is. And what I mean by that is, if I'm suffering from something that's preventing me from being the full expression of myself, or I'm struggling with one of those three areas that you talked about, friends, family, or job, that's okay. You know, and there's just different levels. There's just different, I'm trying to have a tough time articulating, because it just affects everybody. We're just all individuals, you know, and if it's affecting you, you don't need to downplay that. I think you just need to accept it and then try to figure out how you can, you know, overcome it, and deal with it. So I think that I, for a while, didn't want to accept some of these own, like, you know, negative thoughts that I would have in my head, or limiting beliefs. And the more, and I still, I'm challenged with those, but the more that I accept it, I can work on them.
Right. And I think people need to hear that. People, how often have you ever heard, it's okay to worry? It's okay to be uncertain about the future. It's okay to not get out of bed. It's okay to cry. We weren't taught that. That's not something we're taught. We're always taught to fall down, get up. We're, you know, shake it off, man up, whatever you want to say. And I know I gave a lot of examples of men, and I know women have it just as bad. The scrutiny of Demi Lovato, when Kate Spade died by suicide, all of the negative comments that went out about her for those 3 days after, because then on the fourth day, Anthony Bourdain died by suicide, and all of a sudden, the discord changed a little bit and the conversation changed. Because we think, for some reason, just because somebody has money or fame, they shouldn't have a mental illness. The last I checked, depression doesn't check your bank account before you start to feel it. Anybody can feel it. This is the one thing that lacks absolutely zero discrimination, is mental illness. So when you start looking at some of the things that we're talking about for the workplace, and how you can make your help your employees, I think you realize right away, they're not things that are out of the realm of your ability to put out there, and they don't cost anything. I mean, and the number one thing I talked about in the article is, make sure your employees know it's safe for them to discuss and address mental health related issues. That's a minimum. Yeah. Make sure you feel safe. I mean, if I'm lucky that I work in a behavioral health organization. It would be a huge brick wall of irony if I didn't feel safe to publicly disclose all the time that I've been battling depression for 25 years. And I grew up in a household with abuse and drug abuse and all these things. But I feel safe disclosing that there because I'm in a safe environment, but not everybody is. But maybe it's just a supervisor you feel safe with. Maybe it's just a coworker you feel safe with. But you got to be able to, you know, ground level one, foundational level, is make your employees feel safe, and then take the time to educate employees about mental health. And a lot of people are like, we don't have money to bring in therapists and psychologists and professors. And I'm like, yeah, but you have a calendar, and that calendar, it has very specific days on it that lets you bring up mental health. We have Mental Health Awareness Month coming up next month in May. We have Minority Mental Health Awareness Month coming up in July. Suicide Awareness Month coming up in September, World Mental Health Day, October 10th. So there's a lot of calendar things that we can use and post and put on, whether it's you know, Slack channels, or whether it's a company intranet boards, or a lot of different a lot of different closed feeds that organizations have just for employees to bring that awareness about. And when we do our internal leadership training, make sure that's just part of that program, because that only helps our managers and leaders to know that. And then make wellness a priority. I know a lot of people are like, well, we have an EAP program, and that's, you know, an employee assistance program, but those are the most underutilized HR benefits ever, because they're associated with HR. People think they're being tracked, and they're not. But again, a lot of times EAP programs are pretty specific. They can be anywhere from 3 to 6 counseling sessions. And then what do you do? So I think there's a little bit of fear with those being tracked by people and not really understanding the benefit they can have. But I think they have a bigger benefit today than they ever have, because most of us have been conditioned to, if we work and have a great job, we have these great benefits, and that's our safety net for all things health related. But we're realizing there's a shortage of therapists, there's a shortage of counselors and psychiatrists. And if you decide you're going to wake up and like, I'm going to use my benefits, and you call the therapist in your provider network, you're going to get some scary responses. And those responses are usually, we're not seeing clients for at least 3 months, 6 months, or we're not seeing new clients at all because there's a shortage. So now we're like, I'm ready to deal with this, but now my safety net's saying it's not ready for me. What do I do? So these are the kinds of things that, you know, were outlined in the article. And then the last thing was just sharing stories across all levels. I go, it's great for me. And I've been approached by several employees that appreciate my openness about a lot of the challenges that I've had to overcome. You know, it took me a long time to get to that point. I didn't really talk about my mental health, you know, 38 years and younger. Now that I'm about to be 46 this summer, I talk about it all the time because I realize the more I do, the more I help people. So you got to be able to talk about it across all levels, so when people are ready to disclose, they feel safe. And so that's kind of just, you know, in a nutshell what the article outline, but I think it's a lesson for anyone listening to say, what did I just say that's going to cost you a lot of money? It's just mindset. It's just culture.
I appreciate you shared all that. I have to, this was just like, it was just awesome to finally have you on as a guest, and I look forward to doing this again in the future. And I'm glad we just went over a bunch of stuff, and we're going to turn this into a kind of a digestible write-up as well. How can people find you? I know you're active on Twitter. Anything you want to share with the audience as we wrap up?
I'm happy to engage with anybody. You know, the more I write these articles or do webinars, I stay in contact with people that it really connects with, or people that are having their own issues, and I'm happy to be a sounding board for how you can deal with them. So it's just my first name, middle initial, last name, Ian M. Adair on Twitter and Instagram, and we put a lot of really good things out on the Grace Point Foundation Instagram site as well. I know people have found a lot of value in that. So that's just Grace Point FDN, Grace Point Foundation FDN. We put a lot of great stuff out there that kind of help people. Infographics, how can you help somebody that's just disclosed they have a mental health condition? We try to explain and break down things as simply as possible for people wanting to learn more. And that's the best way to get information about me, connect with me, or what we do.
I love it. Thank you so much, Ian, for being on the podcast, and to everyone that continues to listen along and work through these challenging times. We're here for you. All right, take care.